Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 18th of May, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Call, and let's talk about the week that was. Although it's almost tough to know where to begin. We've done the border invasion, although there's, of course, a whole lot more on that front. And there's the other side of that coin, the continuing and attempted coup, ditto. Both of those will no doubt continue until they reach some kind of a climax. We can probably guess what that means. But let's start here, because this one's a bit tougher. When it comes to ramifications that probably aren't obvious, total catastrophe, says a piece from Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog. By Friday, J.P. Morgan was telling their clients it's the perfect storm for U.S. farmers, and yes, the total catastrophe we're talking about is the American agriculture industry, including first, corn production, where he says 30%, and that's all, of U.S. corn fields have been planted so far, but the five-year average is well over twice that at 66%. What that means? 2019's turning out to be a nightmare that never ends for U.S. agriculture. Thanks to endless rain and unprecedented flooding, perhaps even having to do with weather modification, you're not afraid to be called a conspiracy theorist, host interjects here. Fields all over the middle part of the country are absolutely soaked right now, and that's prevented many farmers from even getting their crops in the ground. I knew this was a problem, he wrote, but when I heard that only 30% of cornfields in the U.S. had been planted as of this Sunday, I had a really hard time believing it. But yep, he confirmed it. That number is 100% accurate. And at this point, corn farmers are being pushed up against a wall because their crop insurance final planting dates have either already passed or are coming up very quickly. And in addition, for every day after May 15th that corn is not in the ground, and that was Wednesday, farmers are estimated to lose about 2% of their total yield. Unfortunately, though, more rain is on the way, and it looks like thousands of corn farmers won't be able to plant their corn at all this year. And it's no exaggeration, he says, to claim that we're facing a true national catastrophe. Now, at this point, I want to pause, folks. As we go through the rest of this, I'll point out to you up front, and sadly Snyder doesn't, that of the corn crop in the United States, well over 90%, probably 95% at this point, is genetically modified frankenfood. A lot of that, of course, gets burned up, which is probably the best thing to do with it, but not economically productive, in the form of subsidized, politically correct ethanol. So, for starters, if there's any good news here on the energy front, it's that, well, it won't cost the economy anything to not have something which basically consumes as much energy to grow than it produces back anyway. Here Snyder produces some numbers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, SIC, and the Corn Belt Heartland, like Iowa, which is 48% planted as opposed to a five-year average of 76%, and that's best on the list. Minnesota, only 21% planted, and that's way under their five-year 65% average. But North Dakota and South Dakota are even worse, coming in at 11% and 4% respectively, and that's way, way under their typical average of being about half planted by now. The situation in soybeans, which are perhaps one of the worst of the genetically modified Franken crops, way over 90% of the U.S. crop is GMO'd, and a lot of nutritionists, for a number of reasons, say you shouldn't eat the stuff anyway. And I'm sure if I had been on Twitter or to Facebook, they'd have banned me for saying that just now. In any event, though, the Ag Department and Snyder note that the soybean crop's only 9% planted thus far, behind the five-year average of 29%, so they have more time to recover, but they have other problems besides the toxicity of their crop, from trade wars to soil nutrients and moisture levels. In Illinois, for example, moisture levels in the soil are in the 90th to 99th percentile statewide. In other words, the entire state is completely and utterly drenched, and as a result, very few Illinois farmers have been able to get either GMO'd corn or soybeans into the ground at this point. Arguably, worse even than the Dakotas. And no doubt that's true for the small fraction that plant the real stuff still as well. Now, here's one of the interesting side notes. Normally, if corn farmers have a problem getting their GMO'd corn in the ground, well, they just switch to GMO'd soybeans instead. But thanks to the trade war, soybean exports have plummeted dramatically, and the price of soybeans is the lowest that it's been in a decade. Some of us suggest there might be people waking up to the food value of these things as well. But thanks to information control in the major markets, which still try to ignore there's any difference between the real stuff and the genetically modified varieties, Those figures and the effects are much harder to take a look at. But as a result of all of that, there's little if any profit in even growing soybeans this year, says Snyder. Which might appear to be a bit of a silver lining on one hand, but on the other hand, it represents a whole lot of hurting farm families, and of course, much higher food prices trickling on down, and a whole bunch of follow-on effects from turmoil in agriculture to other effects that'll ripple through into recession or worse. Especially since there's scant hope for sales to one of the formerly biggest buyers, China. Says the story, if the wet conditions persist, many farms aren't going to be able to plant crops at all this year, and sadly, global weather patterns continue to go haywire, with much more rain forecast to come to the middle of the country starting on Friday. Concludes Michael Snyder, we've never had a year quite like this before, and U.S. food production is going to be substantially below expectations. And hey, folks, he didn't even mention California now, did he? Bottom line, get ready for much higher food prices and a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the months ahead. Even, he says, worse than I thought. It's truly a major national crisis, and it's just now getting rolling. From genetically modified Franken crops that won't get planted, let's go next to this, and I'd call it related story, courtesy of Mike Adams and Natural News, except where they've already been banned. Would you believe it begins that Bayer, which purchased the satanic Monsanto a while back, has discovered a black ops division run by their satanic stepchild and shut it down, while simultaneously, they say, initiating an internal investigation as law enforcement prepares criminal charges against the chemical giant. Did you get all that? Well, it says for over a decade, Monsanto, no wonder they changed the name, because I consider that that's the correct pronunciation, has been engaged in building and maintaining hit lists of journalists, lawmakers, and regulators to be taken out if they dare to pose the evil agenda of GMOs and toxic glyphosate weed killer chemicals that now inundate the entire world's food supply. Any influential person who opposed the Monsanto agenda was subject to one or more of the following, says Adams, and he ought to know. Attempted bribery, death threats, intimidation, character assassination through well-funded negative PR campaigns, defamation via coordinated Wikipedia attacks run by Monsanto operatives, career destruction, that goes without saying, I guess, such as getting scientists blacklisted from science journals, sick, and, of course, being doxxed, having their home addresses published, and their families and co-workers threatened. In other words, continues Adams, Monsanto has been running a black ops division for over 10 years, spending perhaps $100 million or more on efforts to silence, destroy, or even assassinate anyone who interfered with the agricultural giant's market dominance, and, of course, their attempt to poison the world. I put that last part in there. Now, though, the criminal mafia activity that Monsanto has carried out for years has finally been exposed as law enforcement closes in on the crimes of this evil agricultural giant, now owned by Bayer, the former IG Farben, too, if you remember your Nazi history, which appears, at least, and some of us would have our doubts, to be making an effort to clean house and end the Monsanto crimes that targeted journalists, lawmakers, and regulators with all of those intimidation campaigns. I suspect, folks, that losing 3 out of 3 major lawsuits, the last one to the tune of $2 billion, you heard that right, billion with a B, of punitive damages to the evil corporation, haven't helped the situation either. Because juries seem to also suspect, with no shortage of evidence by now, that Monsanto covered up evidence of the toxicity of glyphosate and kept on doing what they were making so much money doing, regardless of the effects on innocent people. Here's the story courtesy of Reuters. Quote, French prosecutors said on Friday they'd opened an inquiry after newspaper Le Monde filed a complaint alleging that Monsanto, acquired by Bayer for $63 billion last year, and that's turning out to be a real losing acquisition, had kept a file of over 200 names, including journalists and lawmakers, in hopes of influencing positions on pesticides. And this hit list, as they called it, of journalists and lawmakers, was directly translated into action to intimidate, threaten, or bribe these individuals, just as happens in the United States. In fact, a Monsanto spokesperson now confirms that the so-called Monsanto Mafia used the list to take out anyone standing in the way of their agenda. Quote, there have been a number of cases where, as they would say in football, not the ball was played, but the man or the woman was tackled, admitted Matthias Berninger to Reuters, the head of public affairs and sustainability, sick, at Monsanto. Furthermore, Berninger went on to admit that Monsatan collected, quote, non-publicly available data about individuals. Wonder if there's a two-Facebook, Twitter, and Gulag connection here. Nah, who could imagine such a thing? Maybe it's just big evil tech SOP, and then use that. Bear, though, at least went on to say that they're now apologizing for the behavior. Given that resurrection or even restoring a bit of what they've already destroyed is pretty hard. Mike Adams, for his part, noted that over the last decade, he believes he's been personally hunted by Monsatan-funded black ops teams who intended to destroy, he says, quote, my credibility and physically harm my person in order to silence my public criticism of Monsanto and end the publishing of his website, MonsantoMafia.com, another one, GMO News and Glyphosate News, as well as dozens of other websites that Monsatan didn't want to see published. He goes on to say that Bear is welcome to reach out to him. He would like a genuine attempt to clean things up and a public apology, and says our attorneys are also initiating contact with Bear's legal team to initiate discussions. But Bear, at least, has gone public and said on May 12th they're openly supporting the criminal indictment of Monsatan operatives who ran their black ops division, saying, quote, Bear will fully support the public prosecutor's office in France in its investigation. And then they basically admitted most of the things that Mike Adams has already outlined. I do like Mike Adams' summary. He said the following, and I'll read it verbatim in this case. Quote, Monsanto was run by some of the most evil, criminally-minded people in the history of the world. These people, I believe, are directly responsible for acts of extreme violence, both online and offline, that specifically targeted Monsanto critics like myself. They belong behind bars, and it looks like Bear may actually be willing to help put them there. Yes, he said it's time for Bear to close this chapter on the, and this time I'll pronounce it correctly, Monsatan era of disinformation, destruction, and death. It's time, he concluded, for Bear to come clean. Now, folks, I agree as far as it goes, and Mike obviously has a lot of skin in this game, but I do have to ask another question. Given that so many of us knew the level of toxicity of glyphosate, even though it's taken a long time, just as it did with cigarettes, to finally prove how much death and destruction was associated with products like this in court, and yes, they knew about all of that and more, and yes, they covered it up. So here's the question I have to ask. You would think that one of the world's biggest chemical companies, the former IG Farben, now connected directly to Bayer, would have known, or the legal term, knew or should have known what they were buying for $63 billion. It's called due diligence, and the question, of course, is, why didn't they? Or did they? Isn't there some culpability in that, too? And for crying out loud, now what are they going to do about it? I'd like to see the whole world be informed, you know what? All this genetically modified Franken food, including Franken corn, Franken soy, Franken beets, and all the other Franken stuff with the Terminator genes in it that we've been pushing on the entire world, are straight out of the pit of hell, and we repent. Oh yeah, sure. And the Whoremeister James Comey, along with Clapper and Brennan, are no doubt going to fess up any day now and admit that they covered for Hitlery. Committed a little bit of treason and certainly tried to undermine an election via a coup. No doubt she and Bill will get religion too and repent for all of their crimes. Yeah, sure. But don't hold your breath, folks. So I guess on that note, we do need to return to the various invasions within and without. Let's start with out from the south, where even a few former Obama-era officials are admitting things are worse than they've been telling folks. Former Obama Department of Aktung Homeland Security Jay Johnson warned on Wednesday that the U.S.-Mexico border issue is, quote, very definitely a crisis. Apprehensions he saw at the border back in 2014 were just a fraction of what we're seeing today. Duh. And that everyone should be focusing on a solution to address the issue, because he's worried that the nation's political climate, yeah, could deter a helpful solution. And when you see the solutions that are being proposed, I think that's pretty darn obvious. From there, a case in point, on to Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and his bill unveiled Wednesday that would end asylum claims from Central America at the border. Nothing here about Syrians, Iranians, other Mideasterners, Africans, and others who come across, then go north, and then come in, and return unaccompanied minors to their home countries. A targeted effort, as he calls it, to tackle the escalating migration crisis. Quote, "This is a nightmare for smugglers," claimed Graham. "This is a godsend to stop the humanitarian disaster." Graham's bill, says a piece from Fox News, is designed specifically to deal with loopholes. Well, some loopholes, as we'll see, certainly not the big ones, that he says are encouraging migrants from Central America to make that treacherous journey north and bring children along with them. In particular, he pointed to the 20-day limit for authorities to hold unaccompanied minors and their families once they do successfully get into the United States and the gravy train begins, before having to release them into the homeland. His bill would extend that time from 20 days to 100 days to help allow claims to be filed before families are released into the U.S., and it would also add an additional 500 immigration judges to deal with the backlog of people looking to come on in and suck at the public teat. Now, here's the 20% of the truth in this one, folks. First, he correctly said that a wall isn't enough to fix this. Quote, "No matter how high the wall will be built, no matter how many agents you put at the border, they'll keep coming because they want to get caught. And except for at least some of the terror cells, that's absolutely right." And he's right on this score, too. Said Graham, "The word is out on the street in Central America that if you bring a minor child with you, your chance of being deported goes to almost zero. Your hearing date is years away, and we release you inside the country. And that's the goal of coming," unquote. And that last part is where the big whopping lie is. No, folks, that's only a tiny part of the goal. Notwithstanding the small but no doubt significant percentage that are intent on terror, mayhem, and destruction, here's where Grant transitions into whopper land, saying if we do these four things in his bill, then the incentive created by our laws will cease to exist.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
And this humanitarian crisis will begin to repair itself, unquote. And what a crock of BS. The incentive is a socialist state, where once you get across the border, everything you ever wanted, or at least that's what they're being told, is yours for free forever. And not only that, for your kids, and yeah, your mangy little dog, Toto, too. The incentive is the socialist safety net. Note, neither of the two wings of that same evil bird of prey are even remotely talking about this. And the president may have alluded to it, but he's sure as heck not following through on it anymore. The problem will not stop, folks, and everybody there knows it, even if they won't say it, until people that come north illegally and manage to get into the United States are told, hey, even if we let you stay, you're never ever going to get a dime from the public till. Well, then why bother coming? Those who are willing to work and that are worth having should be willing to follow the law, too. And briefly, just to make that point, what's going to sound at first like a quick digression. From Breitbart, former VP and dictator wannabe Joe Biden admitted that the Second Amendment actually exists. He once read it, but he stressed during his speech in New Hampshire on Tuesday that that doesn't mean everyone is entitled to own a gun. Which kind of makes sense. After all, what the Second Amendment says is that Big Brother can't stop you from owning a gun or even infringe on it in the slightest way, actually, if you're willing to, I don't know, buy it, for example. But what did he say? Yeah, get this. Not everyone is entitled to own a gun. No, folks, but if you can sneak across the border, you're entitled to everything else that Big Brother can provide. From public indoctrination and a college degree, to welfare, to an Obama phone, to free health care forever. And no doubt a universal basic income, too, as long as you don't think you can buy a gun with it. So ponder this. You're no longer entitled to things that were once guaranteed as your God-given rights that could not be infringed, but you are entitled to everything else that the Constitution, when we had one, once prohibited the central government from doing in the first place. No wonder the moochers are streaming like maggots to a corpse. And the fact that neither of the two wings of that same evil bird of prey, i.e. the two so-called parties in Washington, are willing to even remotely admit the problem, much less the solution, which is to shut off the gravy train before you do anything else, tells you all you need to know about why it is that they're not even remotely interested in actually stopping the invasion. Because, of course, the intent was to destroy what's left of the Constitution all along. Quick related story. We knew this was going to happen. Deming, New Mexico, city of about 15,000 and growing, but mostly now illegal, about 35 miles north of the border, declared a state of emergency after a whole bunch of migrants were dumped into that town by federal authorities. Why? Because they hope it will, quote, trigger assistance from both the federal government and the state. Here's a quick two-part, two-Facebook, fascist-style censorship update, starting with Facebook's interference in the Italian elections coming up. Zerohedge says they've banned 23 major Italian pro-populist pages with a combined 2.5 million followers just 2 weeks before the European elections, according to the Italian site La Stampa. The majority of the bans were for supporters of the current coalition government. Among them, La Lega, the League, headed by Interior Minister Matteo Salvini. The European Ministry of Truth doesn't seem to like him at all. The five-star movement, M5S, led by the Deputy Prime Minister. And the problem is that polls have revealed massive support for a party that Two Facebook evidently doesn't want people to hear about. They, of course, claim the sites were spreading fake news, hate speech, and divisive content, which they alone get to define, about immigrants, you ready for this, vaccines, and, of course, Jews, after a left-wing so-called human rights and environmentalist non-government organization, or NGO, issued a report on what they called inauthentic behavior over Italian Facebook networks. Said a spokeslayer for Two Facebook, we're committed to protecting the integrity of the EU elections and around the world.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yes, they continued, not ashamed. We have removed a series of false and duplicate accounts that violated our policies on the subject of authenticity. And they went on to say we've taken further action against pages that have repeatedly spread misinformation and will take further measures if we find other so-called violations. Good grief. Very much related. A piece from Newsbusters notes that Facebook has now scrubbed criticism of the politically correct to the max Rashida Tlaib and her distortions about Palestine and what might appear, if you were allowed to hear it, to be her anti-Semitism. And in this case, it's a Democrat, former New York State Assemblyman Dove Heikind, who posted a video to Facebook about Tlaib's latest whoppers, an interview with the Skullduggery podcast, which seems apropos. Tlaib told that podcast on the 10th of May that, quote, it was my ancestors, Palestinians, who lost their land, and some lost their lives, their livelihood, their human dignity. Their existence in some ways had been wiped out, all in the name of trying to create a safe haven for Jews. Yeah, you heard that right. Post the Holocaust, post the tragedy and horrific persecution of Jews across the world at that time. Unquote. And she was humbled by the fact that it was her ancestors that had to suffer for that to happen. Well, Heikind had evidently had enough, and on May 14th he tweeted, quote, I put out a video yesterday to correct her distortions, and without prior warning or notice thereafter, I woke up today to discover that Facebook had removed my video. It's outrageous to think that a video that did nothing but directly quote Rashida Tlaib, along with the famous video of Hitler meeting with the Palestinian Mufti as they discussed their, quote, shared problems of the Jews, was enough to cause Facebook to censor me. Newsbusters goes on to note that a wide range of outlets, from the Atlantic on the far, far left to President Donald Trump, have all slammed Tlaib over insensitive and historically accurate comments. Those, of course, are being scrubbed from the web as we speak. And I do think it's interesting to go back to the first piece here from Zerohedge, which notes that an Italian daily, La Repubblica, reported on May 2nd that Two Facebook had opened a war room, their terminology, in Dublin, in order to monitor the European elections full-time, with 40 teams of engineers, researchers, scientists, threat specialists, and others for each country that they want to manipulate. Yeah, I put that part in there, folks. 500 people are working on the elections while being assisted by 21 so-called fact-checkers in 14 different languages. And as Zerohedge correctly summarizes all of that, yep, coming soon to a 2020 election near you. Which takes us to the break, and that means that after we get back, we'll talk about those older stories that just keep coming back around. Stay with us. Second segment for this evening. This is your host, Mark Call. And I guess by now we've worked our way back around to the continuing topics that seem to keep cropping up week after week, from the continuing invasion and the waste stream denial thereof, although that's getting harder, to the continuing saga of treason and the waste stream denial of that too. And yes, it's getting harder as well. So let's start our look back with the first big story earlier in the week. Attorney General William Barr has appointed U.S. Attorney John H. Durham of Connecticut to examine the origins of the bogus Russia, Russia, Russia investigation of now President Trump to determine if the FBI's spying on their campaign was, quote, lawful and appropriate. Who are we kidding? And this via Fox News. The move comes, it says, as the Trump administration has demanded answers over the use of informants on his 2016 campaign. Another term, of course, is spies, but the left-wing press doesn't like that one at all in this context, although by Friday, Barr had gone and used the same word again. And according to Fox, Barr is now serious about this and has assembled a team from the DOJ to participate in the probe, adding that Durham is known as a, quote, hard-charging bulldog prosecutor, according to their sources, who also say that the focus of the probe includes the pre-transition period prior to November 7th, Election Day of 2016, including the use and initiation of informants, as well as, of course, potential, and who are we kidding there either, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or Fourth Amendment violating Star Chamber Court abuses. And come on, folks, if we didn't want abuses, we wouldn't have violated the Constitution with the Patriot Act to begin with. Durham, the story suggests, is a good choice because he's previously investigated law enforcement corruption as well as the destruction of CIA videotapes and, get this, relationships of the Boston FBI offices with mobsters, which seems to put him right in Robert Mueller's wheelhouse. Of note, in January, House Republicans Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows wrote to Durham saying that they had discovered he was investigating former FBI General Counselor James Baker over unauthorized leaks to the media, and they added, quote, we know the DOJ and FBI departed from traditional investigative and prosecutorial practices and insufficiently adhered to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, unquote. And how's that for some politically expedient understatement? According to the report, Durham's review would run in parallel with the ongoing and kind of slow, it would seem in hindsight, DOJ probe by Inspector General Michael Horowitz. And meanwhile, the Republicans have been seeking answers as well from, remember this guy? U.S. Attorney for Utah, John Huber, who was appointed by former AG Do-Nothing Jeff Sessions to review FBI and DOJ surveillance abuses, as well as authorities' handling of the probe into the Clinton Foundation corruption. And you probably don't need me to tell you that the stories also say not much has come of anything Huber seems to have been doing, at least so far, for sure. And as I say that, yes, I know, folks, we all do. The wheels of justice turn slowly, and if you really want to get convictions on high-level acts of treason, they do have to be done right. Unless, obviously, as we've seen for 2 years now, it's part of a larger coup. Meanwhile, there may be more news coming out in the short term, if not perps in orange jumpsuits. Speaking on Fox Sunday Morning Futures, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham said, quote, there's a document that's classified that I'm going to try to get unclassified that takes the dossier, meaning the infamous Fusion GPS Steele dossier, all the pages of it, he said, and how it was supposedly verified, adding that there really is no verification other than media reports that were generated by reporters that received the dossier. And as you know, all kinds of information has come to light lately, including notes taken during a meeting 10 days before the deception of the FISA court and the issuing of the bogus warrants, where Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kathleen Cavillac tried to blow the whistle on the Steele BS. Her notes from the meeting have now been revealed, and it now seems like the FBI not only knew what they were doing, but they tried to cover up the fact that they knew as well. Weighing in on this whole mess, former Deputy Assistant U.S. Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, John Yoo, joined Laura Ingraham on the Ingraham Angle on Monday night and told her that the criminals involved here ought to be very worried. Quote, "If I were the Democrats, I would be quite worried. And the reason why is by appointing a U.S. attorney, Attorney General Barr is essentially saying that he thinks it's possible that criminal violations occurred in the start of the whole investigation into any kind of Trump-Russia collusion. And as Judge Starr pointed out, there's already an Inspector General investigation that's been going on that is going to come to a conclusion. And that's what you would do if you were just interested in reforming. But you wouldn't go with a U.S. attorney like Durham or someone of his stature unless the Attorney General thinks something criminal might have happened." And honestly, folks, I think the truth is, we'd have to admit, there's no denying that a whole lot of things criminal happened. The question is whether they've been able to destroy all the evidence and kill all the witnesses yet. In other words, can you prove it, even in what now passes for a deep state court of law? Well, as the week wore on, it seems we might actually be getting closer to that point, because a number of stories started appearing about how the left was beginning to eat its own. In particular, you had the treasonous trio, Brennan, Clapper, and of course, the whoremeister himself, Comey, starting to point fingers at one another. Here's a piece from Zero Hedge that says the FBI-CIA dispute erupts over whether Comey or Brennan pushed the bogus Steele dossier as the Obama regime targeted the Trump campaign. According to Fox News, an email chain exists which indicates that Comey told Bureau subordinates that Brennan insisted on the dossier's inclusion in the Intelligence Community Assessment, ICA, or AKA, the insurance policy, on Russia, Russia, Russia. On Wednesday, the UK's Daily Mail had this headline, "Obama's intelligence chiefs, Brennan and Clapper, claim they told James Comey not to use the Golden Showers dossier to get an eavesdropping warrant on Trump campaign aid." And they followed that up by saying high-level former aides are squaring off on who pushed to include the unverified dossier in the, let's call it, because now we know, wiretapping and spying. But from other sources, we have this. In a statement to Fox, a former CIA official, quote, put the blame squarely on Comey. I like this tweet from the Bradford File. James Comey, James Clapper, and John Brennan are starting to publicly argue who was pushing the dossier that ended up in the intelligence community assessment on Russian interference. The rats are beginning to turn on each other. And even among the GOP, there's disagreement about which rat is worse. Former GOP Representative Trey Gowdy, longtime defender of the FBI, says Zero Hedge's coverage, told Fox News' Martha McCallum on Tuesday night that, quote, Comey has a better argument than Brennan, based on what I've seen, while Senator Rand Paul, as you may recall, back in late March, said that a high-level source told him it was Brennan who insisted that the, quote, unverified and fake Steele dossier be included in the intelligence report. Brennan, he said then, should be asked to testify under oath. Wonder if that'll make any difference. He's lied before. In Congress, ASAP. Also earlier this week on Fox News, Senator Lindsey Graham said he was pushing to declassify documents that would expose the FBI's dismal efforts to verify the claims within the bogus dossier. Quote, there's a document that's classified that I'm going to try to get unclassified that takes the dossier, all the pages of it, and it has verification to one side, said Graham. There really is no verification other than media reports that were generated by reporters that received the dossier. Well, the one thing we know for sure is the fact that it was bogus, unverified, and probably made up out of whole cloth, we know who paid for it anyway, didn't stop it being used by liars to get Star Chamber warrants to spy on the guy that they never wanted to allow into the Oval Office to begin with. I'll admit it, I'd like to see all of them in orange jumpsuits real soon now, because it's been a long time coming. By Friday, though, the president had weighed in, and again he was starting to use the word that hopefully sends shivers down the spines of those who've committed the act he's now describing appropriately. Here's the tweet. My campaign for president, he wrote, was conclusively spied on. Nothing like this has ever happened in American politics. A really bad situation. Treason, and he put it in all caps, and like I said, he mentions it twice here. Treason means long jail sentences, and this was treason. Exclamation point. Which I guess takes us back to the continuing war on the Bill of Rights, too. First, via Big Brother's public-private partners, the socialist media platforms are no longer even trying to hide their outright hatred for conservatives, the Bible, libertarians, and, of course, the written law. Targets over the weekend included Michelle Malkin and Christina Lela. The latter writes that Sharia Twitter, as she put it, locked her out of her account over a 2-year-old tweet which just happened to be critical of Islam, and they forced it to be deleted. Took them a while, though, didn't it? The tech tyrants, she writes, are wrapping up censorship of conservatives and Christians as we head into the 2020 presidential election cycle. Twitter, said Lela, sent me a message Saturday morning letting me know I'd been locked out of my account for violating their very vague and, of course, ever-changing rules against hateful conduct over a non-violent, non-threatening tweet I posted 2 years ago when I defended President Trump against vicious attacks from Hassan Minhaj, an Indian Muslim so-called comedian who smeared the president at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in April 2017, saying during his roast that the president is the liar-in-chief and does not respect the First Amendment. Let the irony of all that sink in for a second here. Although he did admit in the same speech that, quote, only in America can a first-generation Indian-American Muslim kid get on this stage and make fun of the president, unquote. What we're now seeing is that anybody who isn't equally politically correct doesn't get to have any platform at all once they get their way. As Christina Lela writes, well, here I am, a first-generation Armenian-American Christian, and I'm being silenced by Twitter for defending my president and my own beliefs. Let that sink in. By the way, the tweet that got her banned 2 years ago, she said Muslim Hassan Minhaj blasted our president but has no problem with 1,400 years of his religion's barbarism. Uh-oh, somebody must have called the Sharia police. And why am I thinking that if she'd referenced Christian barbarism and, say, the Crusades, there wouldn't have been any problem? I think, folks, the point here isn't that history is replete with nasty examples from all kinds of religions. It's the double standard, the hypocrisy, and the fact that speech in the public square is no longer free on the socialist media platforms. Lela does note correctly that Twitter, to Facebook, YouTube, and Gulag are all purging conservatives and violating the Communications Decency Act, Section 230. Yet Congress, with the exception of a very few, sits back silently and allows the tech companies to meddle in elections and violate that very clear section. Noting that Tucker Carlson at Fox was right when he warned President Trump that if he doesn't deal, and soon, with online censorship against conservatives, he will not be reelected in 2020 because there won't be anyone left to defend him. Concludes Christina Lela, I am a first-generation American of Armenian descent. My Christian family suffered intense persecution in the Middle East and came to America for a better life away from Islam, and now here I am being silenced by far-left, pro-Islam tech tyrants. Conservative author, pundit, blogger, and speaker Michelle Malkin also suffered socialist media censorship over the weekend. She published a post on Facebook defending her conservative friends Laura Loomer and Gavin McInnes, saying, "These are two of my friends. They've been banned from Facebook and Instagram for exercising their right to free speech, while violent jihad groups are allowed on these platforms to spread their murderous poison. I spoke out passionately about deplatforming at CPAC and have done what I can to use my voice to speak for the voiceless." Laura and Gavin are suing the radical forces, including SPLC and CARE, behind the insidious agenda to criminalize political dissent. "I've donated to their causes and hope you will, too," she gives the links, "and I don't know how much longer it'll be before I'm next." Well, the answer was not very, and they removed her post over the weekend. Writes the Gateway Pundit, "We're now at the point where they won't allow any kind words about anybody they don't like, and thus ban." I'll follow that up with a brief story on the same topic, which basically confirms what we already knew. According to data compiled by researchers from Northwestern University, says Zero Hedge's summary, Google's left-wing bias has been exposed. Researchers from Northwestern have used an algorithm to study Google's search results and found an overwhelming left-leaning bias towards news outlets such as CNN and the New York Times, which the search giant repeatedly promoted in November 2017, according to the Daily Mail. Now, here your host will pause and say, folks, I have seen this many, many times, especially over the last month or so. Frequently, I'll see a reference in another story, or somebody will write and ask about an article referencing something, including the exact headline. From a still high-profile but not left-leaning site, I can put the exact search terms in, and guess what? The article I'm looking for often doesn't even show up on the first page. And if it's controversial, you can rest assured the WAPO New York Times and CNN headlines will be saying something exactly contrary to it, whether they admit the truth deep within the text of the article or not. Now, here's where this one gets interesting, and just maybe they're even soft-pedaling the results. Of the 6,302 articles that appeared in Google's top stories box during November of 2017, 62% were from outlets considered to be left-leaning. And of course, guess what, folks? The ones they consider middle of the road are pretty well far left anymore anyway. Just not quite as brazenly so as those at the top of the list. CNN constituted a full 10% of the news promoted, while the New York Times and WAPO came in at 6.5% and 5.6% respectively. So-called conservative Fox News, on the other hand, accounted for just 3% of the promoted stories. And if you look at the list of the top 20, including number 4, BBC, and on down the list, USA Today, L.A. Times, The Guardian, Politico, ABC, CBS, NPR, NBC, CNBC, Reuters, The HuffPo, The Verge, Al Jazeera, and so on, I'd be hard-pressed to name a single source on that list that I'd consider even remotely conservative-leaning. But come to think of it, even constitutionally literate. The story goes on to note that even the number of articles produced from the left-leaning sites seems to inflate those discrepancies. Concluding, quote, if they're serious about supporting digital-first newsrooms, algorithmic news curators, including Google and others, might be more explicit in articulating the inherent design trade-offs between the relevance desirable for individuals, the diversity desirable for society, or, oh, get this, democracy, and the fair competition desirable for news organizations, unquote. Over the weekend, I saw one of the best summaries of the political morass that we've seen in quite a while. This comes from Dmitry Orlov via the Club Orlov blog, and thanks to Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge. They titled it, The World to America, You're Fired. And as Orlov begins, some ironies are just too precious to pass by. The 2016 U.S. presidential elections gave us Donald Trump, a reality TV star whose famous tagline from his show The Apprentice was, You're Fired. Focus on this tagline, he writes. It is all that is important to this story. Although some sufferers of Trump derangement syndrome might disagree, this is because they're laboring under certain misapprehensions that the U.S. is a democracy, or that it even matters who's president. It isn't, and it doesn't. By this point, the choice of president matters about as much as the choice of conductor for the band that plays aboard a ship as it vanishes beneath the waves. I've made these points continuously, he notes, since before Trump got into office, and whether or not you think that Trump was actually elected, he did get in somehow, and there are reasons to believe that this had something to do with this wonderfully refreshing, You're Fired tagline. It's a fair guess that what motivated a whole lot of people to vote for him was their ardent wish that somebody would come along and do that, fire all of the miscreants that infest the Washington, D.C. swamp and surrounding areas. Alas, that he couldn't do. Figurehead leaders are never granted the authority to dismantle the political establishments that install them. But that's not to say it can't be done at all. What happened instead, continues Orlov, was that the political establishment spent 2 years thrashing about in search of a reason to say, you are fired to Trump. But they've been unable to find one, or even make one up, your host notes. And so Trump remains in office, although to say that he remains in power would be to invite sardonic laughter from anyone who knows what real political power smells like or even looks like. Trump, he says, is but a prisoner in the White House. And ironically, the quest for his impeachment has been fruitless as far as firing him, but perhaps more fruitful when it comes to enhancing his ability to not only fire lots of establishment figures, but perhaps even send them to jail with the help of the Department of Justice. And here I have to say, yeah, this is optimistic, I know, so don't hold your breath, but it is at least an interesting take. And just wait, folks, we're coming to the punchline. And it's his character trait, says Dmitry Orlov, of extreme rancor, spitefulness, and vindictiveness that should be most conducive towards that end, making for a fun spectacle. And it's that twist that your host found so refreshing. Orlov goes on to say that his numerous enemies and detractors may yet look back wistfully on the halcyon days when they could lambast him with impunity. All right, well, here Dmitry Orlov regales us with a brief recap of what most of the regular listeners here already know. The fact that the quest to stop Trump at any cost started well before the election, with the Obama regime and the Clintons collaborating on misusing federal resources to dig up something, anything on Trump, specifically, though, evidence of Russia collusion, and they, couldn't find anything, couldn't even make it up, and couldn't get away with it. And as we've heard, if there's no crime, there's no proceeding, nothing to obstruct, influence, or to impede. There ensued, he continues, a sort of bureaucratic dance macabre. Normally, it's the Attorney General who has the authority to provide guidance on questions like that. And Jeff Sessions could have done just that. But as he writes, Sessions had the unfortunate luck of having had a casual chat with the amiable and roly-poly Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak, which contaminated his precious bodily fluids, just breathing the same air as a Russia now can do that. And he was forced to recuse himself from Mueller's investigation. Hey, folks, there may have been other levers applied. But in any case, Trump's legal team then reached out to William Barr, former AG, and asked him to chime in. Barr wrote a memo clarifying the issue, sent it to the deputy AG, Rod Rosenstein. And it eventually all played out as follows. After the midterms, Trump said, "You're fired," to Jeff Sessions, and William Barr was confirmed. Barr then said, "You're fired," to both Rosenstein and Robert Mueller for being unpardonably dense. And he also made it clear he plans to leave no stone unturned in investigating this fantastic instance of misuse of official resources and prosecutorial misconduct. That ought to be fun to watch. But there are things to pay attention to that are even more important. Because there's a whole lot going on right now, and the entire planet is rapidly reconfiguring itself, he writes, to the end that Western European nations are attempting to reclaim the sovereignty they ceded to the United States and the European Union, while Eurasia is coming together to form a massive economic and security conglomerate centered on China and Russia. While the world's central banks do their best to get rid of the U.S. dollar reserves they've been holding and buy gold instead, which, as of this April, they're now allowed to consider a Tier 1 risk-free financial asset. And to make the rest of this long story short, wouldn't it be funny if a lot of the gold supposedly stored in the U.S. turned out to be missing? Meaning that as the time comes for the U.S. to defend its currency by employing its hoard of gold, in spite of high-profile thefts from Iraq, Libya, and Ukraine, the cupboard may well be bare. All right, well, while gold is important, and increasingly so, energy may be more important still, and always will be. Oh, and since the ploy to seize control of Venezuelan oil fields has backfired spectacularly and embarrassingly, defending the U.S. dollar against what's ahead may be a tall order. Here Orlov adds one other interesting observation on the energy markets. Financially ruinous and generally nonsensical schemes such as tar sands, shale oil, and industrial-scale photovoltaics, not to mention wind generation and electric cars, will only accelerate the process of sorting nations into the energy haves and energy have-nots, with the have-nots wiping themselves out sooner rather than later. And, of course, with the help of those who want to put global carbon taxes in place and further destroy the world for the sake of non-existent man-made global warming. Leaving aside pie-in-the-sky things, he writes, like nuclear fusion, space mirrors, and the like, and focusing just on technologies that already exist, he suggests there's only one way in the long term to maintain industrial civilization, which is nuclear. And while your host has more faith in some technologies than Orlov does, there's a really interesting connection in here, I contend. So we'll give him the point and let him continue. So he says, even if you don't like the plutonium-uranium nuclear reactor choice, the biggest player is the Russian state-owned conglomerate Rosatom. Does that name ring a bell? Well, it might, folks, because they own something called Uranium One, and also a person or two that seems to have been involved in, well, I would suggest, acts of treason. Rosatom also owns over a third of the world's nuclear energy market and has a portfolio of international projects, says Orlov, stretching far into the future, including as much as 80% of the reactors that are eventually going to be built. Of course, the U.S. hasn't been able to complete a nuclear reactor in decades, and the Europeans managed to get just one new one online in China, as it turns out, while Japan's nuclear program has been in disarray ever since Fukushima, and since Toshiba's financially disastrous acquisition of Westinghouse. Well, anyway, the bottom line on all of these fronts seems to be that whether you're talking about gold or energy, various players in the United States, your host contends, have been working hard to cut off certain alternatives and perhaps seal our fate. And most folks, concludes Orlov, once they find these things out for themselves, might be tempted to shout them from the rooftops. But that, he dares to say, would be inadvisable. Especially, I can't help but think, in a burgeoning police state. So he suggests the proper thing to do with people who continue to insist on remaining in denial is to humor them, to run out the clock on any games they try to play with you, and then politely bid them adieu. So use the time we have, he says, because time is running out for the U.S., and once it has run out, what we'll hear, in a supreme twist of irony, is the whole world telling the United States, "You're fired," which does seem to get more likely by the day.